From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the October 2014 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. We join you from a slightly soggy red carpet at the Odeon Leicester Square for the UK premiere of the film about Alan Turing, The Imitation Game. The film was chosen to open the BFI London Film Festival and is already the subject of much speculation about Oscar nominations. The crowds have braved the weather to see the stars arrive, and I'm huddled under an umbrella with my boss, Bletchley Park's Director of Communications, Kelsey Griffin. So how exciting is it to be here, Kelsey?
Oh, I can tell you, Catherine, this is amazingly exciting. We've been tracing the development and the build-up of this film for the last 3 years when we first heard about it, culminating last year in some filming that was done on location at Bletchley Park, which was very exciting to have Keira Knightley and Benedict Cumberbatch on site for the filming. And so to have it here today, opening the London Film Festival, is incredible for us. We're hoping that it's going to be an extremely popular film and that many, many thousands of people are going to see it and then be inspired to come and visit Bletchley Park.
Before we go in and watch this hotly anticipated film, let's cast our minds back about a year to when part of the film was shot at Bletchley Park. We spoke then to the screenwriter Graham Moore, the executive producer Teddy Schwartzman, and Dermot Turing, along with his son James, who, if you know where to look, is actually in the film.
What did you do during the war?
I worked in a radio factory.
What did you really do during the war?
Are you paying attention?
If you speak a word of what I'm about to show you, you will be executed.
It's beautiful. It's the greatest encryption device in history. The Germans use it for all major communications.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many have died because of Enigma?
No, I don't.
Three. While we've been having this conversation.
When did you first hear that a movie was in the offing?
I guess I heard about it through the newspapers. It was very interesting to hear that somebody was going to make a movie about Alan Turing and about Bletchley Park. I thought it was great news, actually.
You must be quite familiar with the book that it's based on, I would imagine.
Yes, I have to say I haven't read it for quite a while, but I do dip into it from time to time. People ask me questions, I need to go to it to find out what the answers are.
And that's quite definitive and it's quite factual, whereas this, of course, there's some fictional elaboration around the story, of course, to make it work narratively. That must be a difficult thing for some historians to deal with, but you must perhaps see it slightly differently.
Well, I think it's going to be fun, and I think you have to approach it in that light. I mean, there's plenty of drama in Alan Turing's life story, so it doesn't need a whole lot of embellishment. I think people kind of know the basic story, which was that, you know, having helped break the codes at Bletchley Park, then being one of the computer pioneers, but being a gay man in the 40s and 50s wasn't easy because, of course, homosexual acts were still a criminal offence in those days, and, of course, getting prosecuted and then forced to take this sort of chemical hormone treatment to try and kill off his libido. People might dispute whether there's a cause and effect here, but I'm reasonably confident about it, that leading to his suicide in 1954. You know, that whole story has a, if you like, a Shakespearean element to it. And so I think people know that, but on the whole, it's not really something that's ever been particularly brought to the screen before. And so, you know, it's a great thing to have an opportunity for more people to find out about his life and also to find out about his work at Bletchley Park.
Well, we're obviously delighted that there's such a focus in the movie on his work here and even now that they're filming here. So people will be able to come and see where they've seen in the movie and they'll be able to come and see where it all really happened in the other buildings. So that's exciting. He's become very well known, especially in the last couple of years. When he hit centenary year, there was a great deal of attention on his story and your family, no doubt. How does it feel now, thinking you might actually be about to become more or less a household name?
to be honest with you, to some extent, that is slightly unwelcome in that, you know, one gets lots of sort of phone calls and sort of interest about it. And, you know, sometimes that can be badly informed or
sometimes
people are looking for a particular angle on things, and particularly some members of the family find that quite intrusive, particularly I think when the attention is on the last 2 years of his life, when obviously things were not going particularly well. But on the other hand, I would say that what the centenary year really did, and hopefully people will be able to take away from that the ideas and the thoughts that he had and the contributions he made to so many areas of thought, mathematics, not just the code breaking, but you know, artificial intelligence, and then even developmental biology. It's a huge field that he was covering. And the centenary year events really brought that out. And I think that if you look at his positive achievements and focus less on the tragedy, then there's a lot to celebrate there. And, you know, having him better known for that will be a great thing, to be honest.
It does tend to be the entry point for a lot of people, that it's that contrast of the brilliance and the achievement of him and then that untimely and awful end. And that perhaps is what has made him worthy of a movie.
Yeah, I'd say you can't really sort of separate the two completely. But I think as long as you have a sort of a balanced approach to things and the achievements are there as well as the life story, then that seems to me to be doing him justice. I'm fairly sure that if he had managed to live through those difficult years, he would have been very shy of the publicity and would have felt very embarrassed by even having attention drawn to his sort of academic contributions. And, you know, he was not really ever somebody who wanted to be a public man. And so I think he'd probably feel quite appalled at all the fuss that's been over the last couple of years. I hope he would be pleased that the centenary year stuff was very much focused on thoughts and ideas and how the seeds that he'd planted in the 40s and 50s have sort of grown into big trees that are bearing new academic fruit now. I think he'd probably be quite interested by that. But yes, I think you just can't separate the human drama from the achievements, and it kind of it would be wrong to try and do that.
You've got to wonder about how many of his contemporaries who did live a longer life and saw the seeds they planted here in terms of technology and the development of computing bear fruit, you know, into the 70s and 80s and even 90s and maybe even the last 10 years or so. You've got to wonder what it must be like for them to sit back and watch it all unfold, which is what he would have done if he'd lived through those difficult years, like you say.
Yes, I mean, the other thing I also am intrigued by is if he'd lived longer, what might he have moved on to work on? Because, as I say, he was covering all this incredibly broad landscape of different fields of thought and being probably one of the first people who actually started to use an electronic computer not just to do number crunching, but actually as a research tool to try and explore things like patterns of coats in animals and the way that sunflower seeds are arranged in a sunflower head. You know, those kinds of morphogenesis problems that he was thinking about, and actually using computers to sort of help him solve problems which are a long, long way from what the first people who put electronic computers together were thinking that was going to be doing for computing trajectories for anti-aircraft guns, you know, very complex problem in arithmetic to try and work out what the trajectory of an anti-aircraft missile trying to hit a moving aircraft would be, you know, and there are so many variables, it's very, very complicated. So you can see how you need a big computer to do that. Everybody realizes that's what computers are going to be used for, but very few actually realize you could do it as this sort of amazing tool to do all sorts of other extraordinary things. And now, of course, it's sort of second nature that your, you know, your iPhone it's actually got computing technology at the heart of it. And you know, that's sort of like obvious to people. It certainly wasn't in the 40s and 50s.
You've been able to, in recent years, though, use his legacy to do some good. You know, tell me about some of the charitable work you do, you know, on top of and separately from the Bletchley Park Trust.
Yes, well, not only have I got the privilege of being a trustee here at Bletchley Park, but I'm also a trustee of a small charity set up by my son James, which is called the Turing Trust. And what we do in that is we have a thing called the Alan Turing Computer Recycling Scheme. Computers get out of date very quickly or get superseded by new sort of swishier models. And so people chuck out their old computers. And instead of those sort of rusting on a scrap heap somewhere in your local recycling centre, what we try and do is put them back into use in developing countries. So in particular, we've got a partnering scheme with our sister charity in Ghana, where we send out computers and they're used in schools in Ghana, where, you know, obviously resources are less available. So kids in Ghana can learn, you know, how to use computers on stuff that is great for them to use, even though it's actually been chucked out as being slightly out of date here in Britain. So it's nice to feel that Alan's name is being, you know, perpetuated for, you know, a charitable purpose.
I'd be fascinated to sit in the cinema watching you watching the film. I wonder what that's going to be like for you.
Sitting gripping the edge of my seat. Well, it will be fun. And I also think that history is going to be rewritten in the movie. I think this is going to be quite interesting because the way that Benedict portrays Alan is bound to become the definitive portrayal. And so it will sort of remake history in a strange sort of way. So whatever he does will become how Alan was, even if it isn't how actually he was. So
I think he's working very hard at getting it right and being as authentic as he can. We've had some very, very specific questions to look into. Do you think he's a good choice?
I couldn't imagine anybody better, actually. I think it's perfect casting.
Yeah, because Leonardo DiCaprio was slated for a while to...
No, Benedict. Benedict's a better choice.
I think so. It should be a British actor.
With apologies to Leonardo.
I'm sure he can survive it. So not only have you been helping historically and watching with great interest how this story will be told, you might just recognise someone in the back of shop.
Yes, it's been rather fun because my son James has had this opportunity to become a supporting actor in the movie. And so he, amongst a whole load of other people of his age, are wandering around Bletchley Park wearing 1940s costume, really looking very authentic. It's really quite surprising. But
it's really evocative, actually, seeing them all out the front. I swear, they were all on their mobile phone yesterday. But, you know, you get some modern paraphernalia, but actually it's really atmospheric.
It's very atmospheric. And actually, I feel here I am wearing sort of rather shabby 21st century clothes, and there are all these people dressed wearing World War II uniforms and also World War II non-uniform clothing, and they all look absolutely as if they belong, and I know I'm not in the right place.
I might have stepped up, but I'm far too old. They all wanted people in their 20s. James, is this the first movie you've been in?
Definitely. No, I've never done any sort of acting or anything like that. I'm doing civil engineering at Edinburgh University, so yeah, it's quite a different world to this.
So you've met everyone that's involved with this, obviously, because they're all interested in meeting you and finding out what you know about your distant relative that you never met. So has it been quite an education seeing behind the scenes on something like this? Because you say you're not an actor. You know,
no, I mean, I've never seen anything on a production site at all before, other than the stereotypes of everyone has a trailer. Great. But now actually to see it all come to life is amazing. And then obviously speaking to Benedict yesterday, the amount of knowledge that he had about Alan was just amazing. And the level of detail that he'd gone down to speaking to professors and trying to understand the psychological aspects behind things was just absolutely incredible. He knows things that I've certainly never heard before at all.
He knows probably more about Alan Turing than the two of you put together by now, doesn't he?
Almost definitely.
You must have a little bit of the family sort of notoriety rubbed off on you in the association with Alan Turing, who's ever becoming better known.
Yeah.
What's that like for you?
Yeah, no, definitely. It's very, very strange. You'll get approached by some people, just, you know, you'll be at a party somewhere and someone will be like, Turing, actually, yeah, where have I heard that? And you'll just go, oh, yeah, no, that's happening more often. Or like with the Channel 4 stuff that happened last year or the year before. And then people will be like, was that something to do with you? I was like, yeah, that's very, so it's all very strange. And then especially when you're here on set and you hear, for example, Benedict's just like, oh, Alan Turing has a theory. It's just like, What are you talking about? It's all very strange. It's just like very strange to see it all coming to life, which is great.
It's quite interesting, your experience at university, because when I was at university, I went to King's College, Cambridge, which is where Alan had been, you know, as a don there. And so the people who were fellows of the college knew about him, but none of the students did. Nobody else had heard of him. And so your experience where everybody's heard of him just shows how his reputation has grown in the last 30 years. It's very interesting.
And this will do even more for that, won't it? I mean, it's perhaps on the verge of becoming a household name. Might be an overstatement, but this is a big movie. It's going to bring a lot more attention. What's it like to have people, ooh, actually are cheering, and that'd be sort of all fascinated because of somebody you are far too young to have met, both of you.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's just awesome. It's just really cool. I mean, you've done nothing to sort of achieve anything. It's just completely just luck that it happens to happen. And you're just like, oh, okay. Yeah, no, I've got something really cool about my past, which I can share with people. And they are interested for some reason, which is just amazing.
It must be difficult sometimes that they're interested in the tragedy.
Yeah.
Because there are people within your family who lost him at that young age, and that must be still a little difficult.
I think that's right. And it's not just the family, actually. There are still people who were work colleagues and friends and Alan's students who are still with us. And I do get the sense that it's quite painful for those people having to constantly relive those last few years because people are so interested in it. I guess for us, I don't know, speaking for myself anyway, it feels more distant and therefore not something that I feel quite so personally involved with. That doesn't mean I don't sympathise with those who are around at the time, but I don't feel sort of personally caught up in that.
It's much harder to connect with those sort of experiences, those emotions, because obviously I never even met my grandfather. So I'm even more distant from Alan than most other people are. And yet, because I sort of get the choice of which parts of the story I'd like to connect myself with most. So Alan's childhood and things like that, I've grown up with my brother and we just compare each other every so often, who's more similar in what aspect, things like that, which is kind of the fun, nice things you can do with it. Whereas when it comes to the tragedies, obviously you never want to associate a tragedy with yourself. And so those parts of the story is thoroughly aware of them and appreciate them for everything that they are. But we like to think that the world has moved on. For example, the whole gay issue. In the world that we live in the UK, it's now about gay rights and being able to marry each other, which is a much more positive thing, rather than being persecuted for such beliefs. So you can take it one way or you can take it the other way. So you just basically choose to look on the brighter side of things.
His centenary year brought about a great deal of celebration of his achievements, which was a nice light to throw on the story, isn't it?
I was really thrilled about that. There's a website you can visit, which is the Alan Turing Centenary Year website, and it shows you the vast range of academic conferences and artsy productions and all sorts of strange things that were going on. Can I tell you what my favourite centenary thing was? There's an island off the coast of China where they had a Alan Turing inspired conference, and all the proceedings were in Esperanto, and that was my favourite Alan Turing year event. But that was perhaps at the more extreme end of eclecticism. Most of the stuff was a bit more mainstream, but there was really interesting stuff, you know, not just on mathematics and not just events here at Bletchley Park, but all sorts of things going on at universities and all sorts of institutions all over the world. Really, really amazing, actually.
Of course, it's not all just, you know, movies and showbiz. Tell me about the charity work you do.
Yeah, so the charity we run is called the Turing Trust, named after Alan's legacy, of course. Effectively, what we do is just recycle computers from the UK for our development projects in Africa. Effectively, just using Alan's huge name, we managed to get hold of a lot of IT resources that people would either just be throwing away as waste in the UK or even having to pay to dispose of. And instead, we're just taking them using our volunteer power to recycle them and use them in our schools in Africa. And it is amazing what a name can do. Alan's legacy has truly shown itself in the last couple of years through the sheer amount of IT equipment we've had donated.
Where can people find out more about this?
Just go to www.turingtrust.co.uk. All of our information is up there, especially the computer recycle program. You can also find us on our Facebook page, just search in the Turing Trust. And I believe if you just go into Google Recycle Computer UK, then we should be up there in the top page somewhere.
Excellent. Thank you. And we can look out for you in the background in the beer hut now, can't we?
Yeah, in the back corner of the beer room, actually.
Quietly flirting.
Apparently, I've been told that's my job.
Yeah, good. Well done. So you've got a chat up line for life, James.
Sort of.
Well, see.
Do you like computers?
Someone waving frantically behind you, James. I think you needed to go and flirt again.
Fantastic.
You needed in makeup.
Let's start with you, Graham. How did you get involved?
I have wanted to write about Alan Turing since I was a teenager. It's always been a subject that's fascinated me. It may be sort of hard to imagine now because I'm so hip and cool. But as a teenager, I was fascinated by computer science. I went to computer sleepaway camp every summer when I was a kid. I was really into programming. And so among computer science people, as you don't need me to tell you, Turing is this object of intense study and fascination. So he was always a figure that I was aware of and who had this fascinating life story that I always wanted to write about and always wanted to tell.
We were just saying with Dermot this morning that it's almost Shakespearean, but you couldn't make it up.
Yeah.
His story. The triumph and the tragedy together.
I think that if I had pitched you the Turing story as sort of a fictional thing, you'd be like, no, there's too much there. There's too much story. You'd never believe that all that really happened to one person.
I would agree.
What was your introduction to the Turing story, Teddy?
You know, I was one of those sad Americans who didn't know Alan Turing until I read the screenplay. And then the screenplay led me to Hodge's book, led me to do independent research. And, you know, as a story, as written on its own, just needed to be told. But once you understood more about, you know, the life of the man and the work that happened here at Bletchley, you understood sort of from a historical standpoint the importance of what was accomplished here. And I think that, you know, you can look over the span of Turing's life and point to numerous accomplishments that drastically affected, you know, the way our society turned. But I think if you look in particular at what happened here at Bletchley, it was just fascinating. And while it's been touched on in things like Breaking the Code and through various texts, it's never gotten what we sort of perceive as the proper cinematic treatment, you know, to tell both a riveting drama and something that, you know, frankly, people across the world, not just in the niches where Turing has had sort of the greatest amount of influence, really need to know.
Well, I asked Dermot Turing this morning what he thought of the casting of Benedict Cumberbatch. It couldn't be better. You must be thrilled to have got him for this part.
Yeah, you know, Benedict came to us. He knew a great deal about the life of Alan Turing and understood the challenges of trying to play the role. You know, he'd sort of immersed himself previously in Stephen Hawking, and, you know, I think he thrives in trying to transform, whether it's Julian Assange or Alan Turing, really try to do his best to recreate, you know, that man and find both an amazing performance, but also try and get very true to life in what he's presenting. You know, clearly since he got involved with us, he's had a lot of press on The Fifth Estate, you know, 12 Years a Slave, August Osage County, and Sherlock couldn't be a more enjoyable show. You know, for us, we sort of look less at what else is going on in his life and think about who's appropriate to play this role. And honestly, we couldn't imagine anybody else doing it.
He really does, as Teddy said, bring just a level of sort of depth and immersion and realism to the character that the first time I saw him do it in rehearsals, I sort of gasped. It was better than I could possibly have imagined it. I feel very lucky to have an actor of that caliber, an actor of the caliber of everyone, saying my words, you know, I come off very well on their lips.
What's it like seeing it actually come to life when you've sat alone in a room and written it, and then there's a room full of people?
It's remarkable. I mean, it's sort of, it's funny, I think we were talking about this the other day. You know, we spent so much time talking about the movie. I mean, we've sort of talked about every scene, every line, every moment so many times. And then you finally see it, and there's this sort of amazing moment when we get there, and the cast is there, and we watch the sort of first run-through in the morning, and it'll work. And you have this moment of like, oh, wow, this is actually working. This thing we talked about doing for so long, and this thing we talked about being good for so long, you see it actually in front of the camera, and it's like, wait, this actually is really good. Oh, fantastic. It's
there must be a point at which you have to kind of give it away and allow it to leave your control. It must be quite difficult.
He's trying.
He's trying.
You're laughing quietly.
I'm trying. Yeah, I mean, it's not my film. It's Morton's film. It's Teddy's film. I mean, it's sort of all of ours, right, in a sense.
Yeah. You know, I think Graham has always been protective because he wrote something very difficult to write and something where from a dialogue standpoint and a technical standpoint is, you know, very important to be adhered to. I think once our director, Morton Tilden, came on, you know, the natural evolution of going from writer to director occurred very naturally. And Morton really dove into this world with a vigor and is guiding the ship in a really exceptional way. And, you know, while he is best known in the UK for, you know, his Norwegian thriller Headhunters, he really is quite a sensitive man and an intelligent man who really wants to get to the core of the characters and tell a really powerful character drama, you know, that's being told for entertainment, but for information as well.
It's the challenge we have as the custodians, if you like, of the Bletchley Park story, is to tell it in a very human way. And I can only think that this will really help advance that cause. What's it like, Graham, taking on a true story, a real character that actually lived? Because they don't only live inside your head, they have to live inside your head and have a foot in reality. But there has to be some artistic license as well.
Yeah, I think it's tricky. It's something we've obviously talked about a lot and something I've spent a lot of my adult life thinking about. I've sort of written a number of historical pieces. My first book was historical, my second book is historical, I've written a couple of historical scripts, and there's a huge opportunity there in telling true stories, and there's a huge, I think, obligation, an ethical one, a moral one, to sort of to remain true to sort of the fundamental story about what happened, while at the same time finding ways to make it dramatic.
Make people relate to it.
Well, you know, and embracing the fact that, you know, this medium that we're in is not, we're not telling a documentary.
I keep saying that, then they're not making a documentary. Yeah.
You know, the really great thing we have going for us is, you know, how terribly misrepresented Enigma was, which should give us the benefit of the doubt. You know, we've sort of gone through and tracked, you know, factual accuracies and inaccuracies that we have in the screenplay. And I think that, you know, we reached a balance that we think will give anybody who is familiar with Bletchley and familiar with Alan cause to celebrate that there's a great deal of care in what's being presented, while at the same time, you know, there has to be a recognition of any moviegoer that we're making a movie and there is creative license that is taken in the interests of, you know, telling a satisfying story in this medium. And I think that, you know, it's a complicated question because if you look at the life of Alan and analyze all the various segments, you know, of his life and their impact, there's clearly enough to tell without, you know, any creative license that could run through, you know, BBC, you know, 2-year miniseries. But I think at the same time, we sort of look more at comparisons like The King's Speech, where, you know, you really are telling the core of that story, you're embracing that character, you're putting forth the proper arc of what was accomplished, who they were, getting into the underlying drama of their plight and their accomplishments. But there may be individual incidents that can be dissected like there is in every movie where you can say, well, it might have happened a little bit differently. But I think we really like the balance that we've struck.
Sounds like you're almost anticipating what the critics might say. That must be part of your process as you go through making decisions about how you represent something.
I mean, I think right now we're really focused more on making a great film. I think that when you're analyzing and developing and redeveloping a screenplay that's probably gone through 25 drafts or something of that nature, you know, you're always thinking about your audience and you're thinking about people around the world who will hopefully get a chance to watch the film. You're thinking about people who are intimately familiar with Bletchley. You're thinking about people who, from a technological standpoint, are intimately familiar with computers and, you know, computer science. You're thinking about the gay community and their embracement of Alan as a hero. So we're certainly thinking of all these things as we went through and continue to go through the process. And at a certain point, you know, we need to make the film that we think is the best film for the story we're trying to tell.
What's it like having been here, actually at Bletchley Park, where all this happened, filming some of the scenes?
Oh, it's a dream. I mean, I think it's so nice to have the opportunity to be here at Bletchley where everything happened. And for us, it was very important as American writer, American producers, a Norwegian director, to both staff our entire crew and our cast with people from the UK, and to really do massive amounts of diligence in both our production design, our costume design, our locations. And there's no better location that we could think of than being at Bletchley to shoot The Imitation Game.
We want to keep them in their costume because they dress the place and bring it to life and take it back to the 40s in a way that I've never seen here. And it's wonderful. That image will stay with me of them all relaxing on the oval out the front of the mansion on their mobile phones, but, you know, still looking absolutely the part. It's wonderful.
You know, one of the things that we found most interesting was how young people were when they were at Bletchley, that, you know, this really was a time where, you know, it was a time of chaos, but it was a time of excitement and a time of opportunity where people who, you know, really didn't have much understanding of what they were being tasked to do were thrown together at a very young age and solved really, really intense and massive problems that nobody really thought they could achieve.
But they hadn't had time in their lives to think about what they couldn't do, perhaps. And they've got that kind of youthful optimism on their side. A lot of them were plucked from the midst of university and school and straight out of their basic training in the military. So, you know, they've got that kind of fresh approach to think, why not? Rather than, we can't do this, which, you know, people 10 years older might have thought, you know, it was looking really, really grim. And they didn't know what we know now, that how it turned out.
And I think it's funny, you know, many years later, you look back at the war and knowing how it turned out, you have that in your head when you look back on it. But if you think about what it would have been for these people to actually be here, to actually be at Bletchley, to sort of see the challenges they were facing, it must have felt like you were living through the end of the world. And these were the people who really were sort of right at the edge of that, at the precipice of it. And it's amazing to think that they all came together and very quietly did this thing that, you know, changed the course of the world without telling a soul.
Pull off this genius routine, one actually has to be a genius.
Why are you building a machine?
The machine will allow us to break every message and win the war.
You could help us, but you won't. You will never understand the importance of what I am creating here.
I'm just a mathematician. You've got more secrets than the best of them.
The Sellout Vintage Beauty Workshop 1940s Boutique is back on Saturday the 6th of December. This is a chance to steep yourself in wartime glamour. Learn from an expert vintage stylist, Sarah Dunn, of Sarah's Do What Do's, how to create that iconic 1940s look. The lessons include how to tie your hair into victory rolls, as well as makeup tricks of the era, such as the red lipstick that helped define the decade. Tickets are on sale now. Dot Tuffin was a bomb wren based at Eastcote from 1943 to 44, then posted to Colombo for the rest of the war. When she visited the restored buildings at the Veterans Preview in May, the memories came flooding back.
See, you don't think of it when you're 18 and a half and 19 years old.
Exactly.
It's just, yeah, okay, I was lucky to get into the wrens. I never wanted to go into the ATS, and certainly not into the WAF. So, yeah, I was thrilled a bit. I mean, I was in a reserved occupation, so I didn't need to do this. And my mother was livid, of course. She lost 12 and 6 a week. As soon as you started work, you had to pay into the family. I went for the job at George Wimpey's, and interviews were different. The chappie said to me, you know, okay, interviewed me, yes, I seem to be reasonably intelligent and all those things. Yes, you do for so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so. And what was your father in during the war? Now, that was important, always. If you turned around and said non-combatant half the time, you didn't get the job. So I said to him, no, my father was in the King's Own. I was being interviewed for 12 and 6 for a 5.5-day week. He looked at me and he got up, shook my hand, he said, that's wonderful. So was I. You get 17 and 6 months instead of 12 and 6. So it was a different world. It wasn't money. orientated and things like that. They wanted to know about you when you went for a job. Yeah. But I reckon because I was in Wimpy's, that's when I got into the Wrens, they thought, yes, Wimpy's are building aerodromes. So this one has obviously learned to keep her tongue. Otherwise, you wouldn't, I mean, you'd hardly sit down and have a coffee with you and say, did you know? You know, we're all not only doing aerodromes for ourselves, but we're actually doing them now for the Yanks as well. Yeah. So these are things they obviously sussed out. But I had no qualifications to come to Bletchley. I wasn't very good at crossword puzzles.
That's just one thing that people were picked for. Tell me again about how you were trained.
We weren't trained. We came down to Bletchley after our 6 weeks of interrogation. They sussed out that we all, they'd obviously look reasonable. So we'll have this lot. 160 of us were on the intake. Only about 45 to 50 of us completed the course. And that was from security and all those things. Now, when I came down here, I was only here for a short time. And then, consequently, the bomb was really being manufactured. And then they obviously had an intake of bombs at Eastcote. So, consequently, we were drafted into Eastcote. And Alan Turing did very well with the German code over at Stanmore. So they had some, obviously, some empty bombs there. So about a dozen of us were transferred over to Stanmore. So I really did quite well for doing and seeing what was going on. But as you say, it was only bits and pieces, really and truly, of anything. You never knew the whole story. I mean, the Enigma, we didn't even know about. I mean, we'd all sussed out what was going on, but there was never any chat. You didn't have a chat. The simple reason that it was instilled into you during your interrogation and your security lectures. Yeah, one word from you, and a whole battalion of men will be wiped out. And when you're 18 years old, or nearly 19, we all knew boys, they'd all gone. You know, my husband and I used to say we were the lucky ones, we came back. He also was in the Navy, not that I met him there, but he was in the Navy, and he was in tank landing craft. But he went in, you know, into that section, and he was in D-Day. It was interesting, but we never talked about it.
I think there's been a huge cultural shift in the time since then. People struggle with the idea of the secrecy, but we try to explain it was necessary and that everybody understood that everyone had a part to play.
Yes, and you played it. Big stations out of London didn't have any names on. If you didn't know how many stops it was to get to Auntie Beach, yeah, and you thought it was five, you look at five, it wouldn't tell you it was the wrong station because it had no name on it. So you were used to secrecy. And always, you know, in pubs and things, not that I was allowed to go to a pub, of course, my parents wouldn't allow it, but in pubs and libraries, all these notices. And then, of course, when the Yanks arrived, we all added our own notice, you know. The Yanks are coming, over here, overpaid, and oversexed. And they all proved to be exactly the same.
Yeah. It was true then, was it?
Yes, but I mean, that is just the way that people, you know, interpret things. It was a joke, and they weren't Americans for years. They were always called Yanks, yeah.
Loose lips sink ships. It was a national endeavour. You know, everybody felt that they were part of it. That was quite a trick of propaganda when you think about
Absolutely, yes. Oh, yes, when we were in Burma, we had four subbies, eight wrens, and a commander, and that was our office. We had no windows. We had two doors. One led into the courtyard where we could get a cup of tea. The other one led into the jungle. Pretty obvious one. We were in operations, yeah. But luckily the Japs didn't get to us, so that was that. But our commander there couldn't stand the Yanks. If ever they were having a little trot round, he would say, girls, you know what to do, don't you? But when they used to come to me, you know, what are you doing? Well, I'm doing pensions for retiring captains in the middle of a war. The only time he got really angry was when we'd had three people round in a week. I always stuck to the same story, and they would go away, looking at as much as to say, what the hell are they talking about? But we never told them what we were doing anyway, because it was run the same as Bletchley. You only knew what you knew. One wren turned around to this American officer and said, oh no, she said, I'm doing the milk bill for the week. when the room emptied, Commander Mary said, "Don't you ever go that far again." So, yeah, there were jokes you played, but he reckoned you told one American one thing and the whole of America knew the next morning. So that was his philosophy. So he was very tough.
Some of the civilian girls who here at Bletchley used to tell chaps when they were out and they would meet people, they'd say, "We give the medals out." So that made them popular.
Yes.
And that was just a British
service. Well, that's right, yes. But nobody ever asked you.
That's what people struggle to understand now, is that, you know, so, but what didn't people ask? It's the lack of asking and the lack of expecting to know what other people were doing that people struggle with.
Yes.
Rather than keeping a secret. You almost didn't really need to keep the secret.
No. And you see, one side of Bletchley never knew what the other side was doing. And that was their cover, and that was really what was wonderful. I mean, you didn't really want to know what somebody was doing. I mean, mainly, you know, you were either working or you had your free time. And just occasionally, you know, you get one naughty wren. We used to have church parade once a month, and I found out after I'd been in the wrens about 6 to 8 weeks, some of the girls actually seemed to disappear after church parade. So I said, "Where do you go to?" And they said, "Oh, we're Roman Catholics." So the Roman Catholic mums take us home. So I thought that was a good idea. So I said to three of my friends, "How about becoming Roman Catholic?" They said, "Dot, you can't do that." I said, "Why not? They don't know we aren't a new intake.
You might get a nice roast dinner."
Yeah. So we became Roman Catholics and we went home and we had dinner, we had lunch, yeah. And, you know, cake to take back to the Rennery with us. It was lovely for about 6 weeks until one of our officers found out.
Oh no, I bet you were in trouble.
Well, I didn't get gated, yes, so that was lucky, yeah. These are things that in private life you did as kids, you know. At our school, we had a flat roof over the toilets. We weren't allowed to climb up that. The boys used to quietly get up in however many seconds or minutes it took them. So they challenged us girls. Well, I got up before the boy that was climbing his side. I got up on my side. I was so delighted. I said, "I made it." And of course, yes, my mother was sent for.
Yeah, that ruined it for everyone.
Yes.
She was so triumphant.
That's right. But you'll always get people that are like that anyway, and I've always been a little bit like that. Not naughty things.
That's quite innocent. You didn't think about the fact that if you stood up and shouted, you'd get everyone in trouble.
No, it didn't occur to me. I was so thrilled that I'd made it. Yeah. And I had bright red hair, so it was never very difficult to know who was at the bottom of something. Yeah. But that's the way you are. That's the way you're made. You've got to have fun. You know, you don't have to be naughty, naughty. I don't think I ever got my bottom pinched, you know, in the rent. Simple reason, you're going to pinch some flaming redhead's bottom. Everybody's going to know about it. So it's a safeguard as well. Yeah, it got me into more trouble than some. But we had a great crowd and the girls were all lovely. We had two ladies and we had three right honourables. So consequently, there were quite a lot of, I say, you know, okay, my goodness me. Yeah. So it was a different life. We were 70 years old before my husband knew that I was even at Bletchley, what I did during the war. For our birthdays, we were allowed to go anywhere. You could go to the Ritz for a tea. You could go to the Savoy for dinner. It was a special day. So on the special day of my 70th birthday, I said to my husband, "I'd like to go to Bletchley Park." "What the hell do you want to go there?" "It's all a myth, Dot." He said, "There's nothing there. Absolutely nothing there." He said, "It's just a big old house. They're obviously wanting to make money out of it. Some bright spark has hit on a good idea." "I'm not going." I said, "We're allowed to go where we like on our birthdays. You went where you wanted on your birthday, so I'm allowed." Anyway, he got up in a mood, as men can do on occasions. So we got into the car in a mood. So halfway here, him still complaining. I thought, well, perhaps I'd better tell him. So I said, "Pull the car over, I've got something to tell you." He said, "No good pulling the car over, there's no toilets round here." I said, "I don't need the toilet." And I told him that I was at Bletchley, and then on the other stations, and how I actually got to the Burma War, he could not believe it. My God, he said my golfing lot say to me, how the hell did Doc manage to get out to Colombo during the war? I don't know, he said, it's just where she was drafted. We got to the gate, the Master of Arms came out, and he said, you know, I'll be selling, I think, about £2 more. My husband said, I'm not paying for her. I've just found out after all these years that she was here. She was actually in the Burma War as well, and I didn't even know it. I just got thought she'd been drafted out to Colombo. So he said, I'm not paying for her. So the Master of Arms said, you're paying for her, sir. It's £2 for each of you. There you are. So there's always little fun bits that, if you like, make life a little more durable, even if you're in the wrong place, yes. But you have to have a good memory for the simple reason that if you're not careful, you see so much on television.
This is true.
Yeah, but I've checked all my bits and pieces. Some years ago, I wrote bits and pieces down that were important. And I've checked all of those, and I still remember them the same way. But you've got to be careful you don't pick up things. I mean, when we were in Burma, I volunteered with, and my friend volunteered, but she didn't know till the next day she had, to see the boys in the Red Cross ships come back. Now, they were pitiful. Remember, we were still very young. Two Wrens took 12 boys out. They came off their ship. We had a minibus, and we were given some money and 12 bottles of beer. We could go to a certain place for lunch, because their stomachs were in terrible state. So the lunch was all prepared for that. The boys could have their bottle of beer, and if he didn't want beer, we had to open it and throw it away so that you didn't give it to your buddy that was next door, because his stomach couldn't take two bottles. We took them round Colombo. They bought little presents, you know, for their loved ones. By that time, of course, we knew them. They knew I was Dot, and they were Jim, and he was Bill. And they showed us some of the things that we now see on television and take for granted. Holes, you know, in their buttocks. One chap, his body looked as if it had been stitched together. He put his shirt up. He said, look, he said, I'm terrified to go home. He said, what is my wife going to think when she sees me? It looked as if he'd been whipped and poked. And these are things we now know, but we didn't know them then. And you had to come back into normal life. You didn't come back as a hero. The heroes were dead. You weren't the hero. You came back. You've got to get on with your life. It wasn't a make-believe world. You had to get on with it. I got £42 when I left the Wrens. My husband, who was an officer, he got 78. After we'd been home about 2.5 years, we got married. Our first home was a gaslit flat in Acton. And we had one bathroom and three lots of tenants on different floors. And we all used the same bathroom, the same toilet and everything. You didn't bother to talk about it because nobody after the war was going to believe you. Because this place didn't exist. Didn't exist for my husband. Yeah. And if he didn't know, there was no point. My husband only told the grandchildren over in Australia about 6 years ago. Because he was D-Day tank landing craft, and somebody came in and happened to mention you were in the Navy, one day, and he said, yes, what were you doing? So he told them. But he said, showed the grandchildren, they were there. That's two boys and one girl. And they said, you really want to know what your grandma was doing? And they said, yes, she was in the Wrens, and she was probably a cook or somebody. And my husband said, I'll tell you what she was doing. Kids couldn't believe it, so I went up a notch.
Dot, you have a wonderful story to tell.
Not really,
so
the same as other people. Everybody had their own story. My husband would wear his medals on Armistice Day. We would hug each other and say, we were the lucky ones, we came back. A load of our boys didn't come back. Yeah. So this is what was important then. It would have been lovely to have seen our boys come back to Wimpy's because they kept our jobs open for us. And it would have been lovely to have all sat down in the same office and seen the same boys there. They weren't home. So this is what matters, yeah.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, where we are at BPark Podcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.